Senator Obama was the first African-American editor of the Harvard Law Review. He turned down a prestigious clerkship and offered a return to Chicago to become a community activist and civil rights attorney. He taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago, spent 8 years in the Illinois State Senate, and then in 2004 gave the keynote address at the Democratic Convention, and a few months later, in November, elected with 70% of the vote as United States Senator from Illinois. He is now working on a second book, The Audacity of Hope, which is out this fall. Time magazine said he's one of the 100 most influential people in the world, listing him under the leaders and revolutionaries. I think I should ask him which one. He is here to talk about all that and more, and of most importance to me, obviously, he has been on Meet the Press 3 times, and I think he'll be on a whole lot more. Ladies and gentlemen, United States Senator from Illinois, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Good to see you guys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. What a great crowd. Well, Tim, thank you so much for the wonderful introduction. Max, thank you for all that you do, and congratulations to the partnership for its outstanding work. I'm not going to give a long speech because I want to dive into the conversation with Tim right away, but I will tell you that when I first ran for office, it was in 1995, and I had been a community organizer. I was teaching at the University of Chicago Law School, and I had been active in civil rights work across the city of Chicago, and the state senate seat where I lived had opened up. And so some friends of mine and colleagues came up, and they said, you should run for this state senate seat. And I did what every wise man does when confronted with such a decision. I prayed on it, and I asked my wife. And after consulting those two higher powers, I did what every first-time candidate does, which is to talk to anybody who will listen. So I went to block club meetings and PTA meetings and barber shops and beauty shops, and if there were two guys standing on a corner, I'd pull up and I'd start handing them literature. And everywhere I went, I'd always get the same two questions. The first question is, how do you pronounce your name? And people would, say it all sorts of ways. They'd call me Alabama, or they'd call me Yo Mama, and I'd have to explain, no, it's Obama, and my father was from Kenya, which is where I got my name from, and my mother's from Kansas, which is where I got my accent from. And so that satisfied them. But the second question was harder to answer, because people would look at my literature, and they'd see some of the stuff that I'd done, and see a picture of Michelle, and they'd say, you seem like a nice young man. You've got a law degree from a fancy school. You teach at a fine school. You're practicing law. Beautiful wife. Why would somebody like you want to go into something dirty and nasty like politics? Why would you want to go into politics? And I think the question's understandable because the truth is that we as a culture feel an enormous cynicism, not just about politics, but about public life and public service generally. I think there's a sense that so much of government has become a business and not a mission, and that power is always trumping principle. And we see a lot of self-appointed leaders who are long on rhetoric, but short on substance. And so we get discouraged. And many of us pull back into a very private life. And we tend to our own private gardens, and we send our kids to private schools, and we try to make as much money as we can so that we can protect ourselves from whatever chaos is going on out there. But what I told people that first time when I started to run Now, what I tell people, especially young people today, is that there's always been another tradition to government and politics and public service. It's a tradition best described, I think, by Dr. King when he said that an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. A sense that we're connected as a people, and that what happens to a child in some poor neighborhood of Washington, D.C. has an impact on all of us. If they can't read, if they are struggling with violence and despair, that somehow that touches on our life. That if we have a situation across the world in which millions of people are displaced from their homes and threatened with violence and fear, that somehow that makes our lives a little poor. And so the possibility for us to engage in the process, not of perfecting the world, but improving it, pushing that boulder up the hill so that at the end of our lifetimes we can look back and say, we've made a difference. I can't imagine a more worthy project. And you don't have to be in government to do it, but government is one of the most important vehicles by which we do it. Now, most of the people here are going to have enormous opportunities for so many things, and you can live an outstanding life and make an outstanding contribution to your society in the private sector. So I don't mean to belittle that. But I do think that it's important for all of you to consider what are the risks that you're willing to take so that you are not just following the conventional path? Because our society constantly tells you that the thing that's most important is a big bank account, a fancy house, a fast car. And all those things are nice, but in the end, I think they show a poverty of ambition. And the last note I'll make, and then I'll sit down, is that I tell you that not to try to guilt trip you. It's not just because you have a debt to the people who helped make your life a little bit better, although I think you do have that debt. And it's not just because you have an obligation, fortunate, although I do think you have that obligation. But it's actually because I think you have an obligation to yourself. The people I know who are satisfied in their lives, who feel good, have somehow hitched their life up to something larger than themselves. That's how they fulfilled their potential, by looking outward and spreading their influence. And I can't imagine a better way of doing that than being involved in public service. So I hope that all of you continue on the path that you're already on. And with that, let me sit down and subject myself to questions. Tim, I wanted to make sure you're not going to be posting some of my old quotes on the screen, are you? The first time I was on Tim Russert, this is, I'm already nervous because I'm about to speak at this convention. And he pulls up a quote that I gave in 1996 to the Cleveland Plain Dealer when I wasn't even a state senator yet, in which I said that I thought political conventions had become these corrupt sort of, love fest between corporate lobbyists and political insiders. And he flashed that quote on the screen and asked me, do you still believe this as you're about to be the keynote speaker? And so I'm hoping no similar surprises come up today. Thank you, guys.
Well, do you still believe it, Senator? No.
What do you think the biggest challenges that will confront this generation of Americans as they embark on their careers in or out of public service?
Well, we have so many that it's hard to know where to start. But I think the most fundamental challenge that this generation is going to face is that we are in the midst of a transition similar to the transition we made from the agricultural age to the industrial age. You know, it's interesting. I've been spending a lot of time reading about economic history in this country. And when you right around the time of the Civil War, obviously there was enormous tumult as a consequence of the issue of slavery. But what was also happening was that people were moving off the farms into the cities. You know, industrial capitalism was starting to take root. The country was beginning to get stitched together. We had to figure out what were the structures that would ensure the dynamism of the economy, but still provide people some means to support their families, not get exploited, have a workplace that was safe, and so forth. And you know, one of the amazing things about Lincoln, you know, obviously, rightly, we focus on him leading our country through Civil War and the Union and the Emancipation Proclamation. But what was also interesting was what he did in terms of you know, helping create an infrastructure for the country through the railroads and so forth, creating a Homestead Act in which people could move west and get land so that they could have a stake in this new economy, creating a system of colleges all across the country to educate the workforce for this new economy. And we're going through, I think, that same transition, but now we're going through it globally. And so the challenges that we have are figuring out how do we benefit from globalization, trade, innovation, automation, all the things that modern life have to offer. How do we benefit from the cultural exchanges and interactions with other nations? But how do we do so in a way that doesn't make the American people more vulnerable? Because right now they are. They are more vulnerable economically to changes in the economy. The safety net has frayed. It is no longer functioning in a way that protects people on health care and retirement. The competitive environment is much greater for this generation than it was for ours. So our education system has to be entirely revamped. With China and India developing, they are making demands on our energy resources. That means that we can't continue sort of the profligate manner in which we use energy. And so no, at no time, I think, has there been a more important moment to revamp government in a way that's responsive to these underlying economic challenges, and I think that's what all of these folks are going to have to spend their time doing.
My son, Luke, who's here with me today, is going to be a junior at Boston College. He was watching an interview I did with Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein talking about Watergate, and Woodward would explain that when he wanted to talk to his source, Deep Throat, he would put a red flag on the back of his apartment or drop off a New York Times with page A8 circled. And Luke said, you know, why didn't they send him an email? Why didn't he call him on his cell phone? You know? And these kids are capable. And then Luke showed me Facebook. You'll find Luke on Facebook. He has a lot of friends, let me tell you. But all that being said, this generation, what they can do with their computer, with their phone, and their ability to organize.
Right.
And then I compare that to our government with Katrina, or front page of the papers today where 8 out of 10 cities still can't communicate between police and fire. What do we have to do to our federal government so that this generation can deal with it in a way that is equal to their technological savvy?
Well, this is where the opportunity, I think, comes in for them because you're right. We've got a bureaucracy government structure that was designed that really hasn't been updated since the 30s and 40s. We are still using a FDR model or FDR era government to deal with 21st century challenges. Some of those issues that have to be dealt with are technological, as you said, setting up a system so that one of the bills that I just have introduced recently is using computer technology to make sure that when you have a disaster like you had in Katrina, that there's a centralized place where people can track their families. It's not that hard to do, as you said. These folks do it all the time. But we just need to update technology. But there's also, organizationally, this is a generation, and this is an area I know the partnership has been active in. Organizationally, this is a generation that's much more accustomed to not the command and control top-down, 18 layers of bureaucracy before decisions are made, but rather much more comfortable with teams and networks, problem-solving in a more horizontal as opposed to vertical way. And we haven't applied a lot of those lessons yet to government, which means that it's less nimble, it's less capable of making quick decisions and adapting to new circumstances. And I think that's the kind of wisdom that potentially this new generation can bring that will make government function better.
When I first had the honor of working in the U.S. Senate, I used to watch Republican-conservative Barry Goldwater debate Democratic-liberal Hubert Humphrey. Robust, fiery, philosophical debates. And then they go off and have a cup of coffee together and try to find common ground. The Washington Post said I was the first to use the phrase red state, blue state. And now I wonder, in using that phrase, what we have done to our politics. At your keynote address in Boston, you said we worship an awesome God in the blue states and we don't like federal agents poking around our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. What were you trying to say?
Well, the country is not as divided as Washington is. Well, one of the things that I'm always struck by when I travel, not just in Illinois, but around the country, is that there's all this cross-pollination taking place between people of different races, different religions, different cultures. And the core values, I think, that most Americans have are remarkably similar across demographics. Our politics has come to be defined by magnifying our differences and finding those wedge issues around which to rally the two poles in our political thinking, as opposed to thinking about what are the things that bring us together. I remember when I first got elected to the state senate, I took a tour of southern Illinois. And for those of you who know Illinois, southern Illinois is the south. I mean, it's much closer to Little Rock and Memphis than it is to Chicago, both culturally and geographically. And so we're driving down there and it's mostly farm country and, cornfields and bean fields. And I go to a little reception in DuCoin, a tiny little town. And I'm talking to the DuCoin's state's attorney. And I ask him, what are you dealing with here in DuCoin? And I'm thinking, cattle rustling or, folks are hunting out of season or something. And he's munching on a carrot and he says, actually, we've got a branch of the gangster disciples down here. Some white kids who, are in the whole hip hop thing and they're dealing crack. And so we're having to cope with that. And it just reminded me that both the good and the bad of this country is out there, and people are struggling with very similar problems. And if government can focus, if our politics and our government can focus on those things that bind us together, as opposed to those things that drive us apart, then I think we'll be able to solve some of the problems that we face.
When you see an issue like entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, 40 million people now on it, it's going to be 80 million in the next 15 years, and this generation is going to pay for it. It doesn't strike me that the political climate in Washington, Democrats, Republicans, is such that people can come together in a bipartisan way when they all know privately what the problem is. Or the war in Iraq, 135,000 people on the ground, whether you're for the war or against the war, it's going to take the country coming together and figuring out just what is our policy, or with Iran or North Korea. It's not going to be a Democrat or Republican policy. It's going to be an American policy. Is it now possible with our politics to come together in a big bipartisan way to deal with those big issues?
I think it's possible, but we're going to have to look at some structural changes in how our politics operate in order to I think, encourage more cooperation as opposed to less. A couple of things. One, political gerrymandering, I think, has contributed to the divisions between parties in a profound way. Whether it's in Congress or at the state level, those who draw the maps have become so precise and adept at making sure that this is guaranteed to be a Republican seat or this is guaranteed to be a Democratic seat. For example, in this election, you've got out of 435 House seats, I think 35 are actually competitive. In that environment, what happens is that if you're a Democrat in a Democratic district, you really don't have to reach out to Republicans. You just have to make sure that your left flank is covered in a primary. Same thing with the Republicans, right? A Republican is much more worried about the Club for Growth coming in and running a primary campaign. And so what happens then is that each side starts playing to its left or right wing. And there's not much reward for bipartisanship in the election process. So that, I think, has contributed to the polarization. I think how we are organized here in Washington, there's actually very little debate on the floor of the Senate now. Essentially, when people stand up and deliver a speech, they're doing so to an empty chamber, to the C-SPAN camera. But there's no deliberation that's actually taking place. What's happening is you've got competing press conferences. And then we've got a media that's become more segmented. Now that's one of the downsides of the new technology, is that it used to be everybody's watching Walter Cronkite or Edward R. Murrow. And there's some sense that we're all part of a common worldview. We're seeing the same thing, and then we may have different opinions about what we're seeing. But now, if you watch Fox News, you've got a completely different worldview than if you're reading the New York Times editorial page. And that, I think, has caused problems. So part of our task, I think, is to figure out how do we build more forums, more conversation, more space in which everybody is in a conversation. I have a confidence that when people sit down and talk to each other, that it turns out that that we can solve problems, that the people will have an instinct for what makes sense. But if we're not in conversation at all, then I think we're going to have problems, especially on tough issues like entitlement reform.
You gave several speeches recently that I've read on civility, empathy, faith. And I'm thinking the last couple of days when I interviewed Josh Bolton, White House Chief of Staff, about Tony Snow, use of the word murder to talk about embryonic stem cell research, and he apologized, realizing that you may have difference of opinion on that, but that's a kind of a harsh word to use. You tell a story about your campaign literature about a sensitive issue like abortion, and you got a letter from a doctor. Tell us about that.
This is during the campaign, and anybody here who's worked on a campaign or has seen campaign literature knows that people use shorthand, Democrats, Republicans, especially in primaries. Again, this goes to the point of sort of gerrymandering. So during the campaign, we had used some shorthand about the fact that I was pro-choice by saying, it was worded something to the effect of, Barack Obama will protect a woman's right to choose from assaults from right-wing ideologues, I think was the phrase we used. And I got a letter from a doctor at the University of Chicago who told me he had voted for me in the primary, was inspired by my message, but wanted to let me know that he might not vote for me in the general, and the reason was because he had seen this piece of literature on my website describing this remark on my website, and he said that he was pro-choice. He was a committed Christian. He was pro-life, rather. He was adamantly opposed to abortion, and he also thought that his Christian commitment meant that he should oppose some of the militarism that he saw coming out of the Bush White House, that he was distressed by policies that advantage the wealthy over the poor. And so he had a complicated worldview. It wasn't simplistic left or right. And he said that he didn't have a litmus test in terms of whether he'd vote for me or not. The fact that I was pro-choice alone was not his problem. His problem was is that by describing anybody who opposed abortion as a right-wing ideologue, that he thought that was not fair-minded, that he thought that that showed a callousness towards the issue that was inappropriate. And I wrote back to him and I said, "You're right. We had gotten sloppy and careless. We slipped into the cant and the sound bites that politics typifies." And so I had the website changed. I don't know whether he voted for me or not. He never told me. But he taught me an important lesson, which is the language that we use is important, and that it is possible to disagree without being disagreeable and without questioning other people's motives. And that's a lesson that I've tried to carry forward and instill in my own staff and in terms of how we operate.
Why don't we open up for some questions? I know there are lots of them here. Go right ahead. Please stand and give your name. Go ahead.
My name is Ben, and I work for Citizens for Tax Justice. We live in kind of a political culture that is very demeaning of public service. I think an example is after September 11th, Bush's big message to our generation about how we could help was to go shopping. Yeah. And conservatives have really fostered kind of a political discussion that says that government can't do any good at all. And so I guess I'm wondering what you're going to try to do to shift the political climate to change sort of the way we talk about government and service and the possibility, of government doing good for its citizens.
I think that one of the things that first of all, could everybody hear the question? Okay, so, all right, I just thought of that. There are some mics over there, so I think...
Each of the aisles, yeah.
Why don't we have people who are going to ask questions start lining up, and I may not get to everybody in the line, but at least that way I won't have to repeat each question. The question was, what can we do to restore some sense that public service actually matters, because we have a culture that kind of runs down government all the time or the public sector? I actually think the tragedies both of 9/11 and Katrina in particular have started to shift attitudes in the country about the importance of government. I think you're right that throughout the 80s and 90s, there was an assault on the very idea of government. I think that some of that was a useful correction, because even though I profoundly disagreed with Ronald Reagan on a whole bunch of things, I do think that what the conservative movement identified in the late 70s and early 80s was a tendency to think that government could solve every problem, a certain cavalierness about spending taxpayer dollars, a lack of regard in terms of the efficiency of government, an unwillingness to question whether or not market-based solutions in some situations could do better than a traditional command-and-control approach. So there had been a useful correction, and then the pendulum swung way over here. And what happened, I think, with both 9/11 and Katrina was people started to say, you know what, actually having a federal government that is competent enough to make sure people aren't on rooftops for 3 days is a good thing. And so what we need to do then is build on that new sense that
government, a smart, effective government is needed. And what that means, I think, is to do what Tim talked about, which is work hard to redesign government so that we're getting more bang for the buck from the government that we have, and to highlight those areas where government works well, but also fix those areas where government doesn't work. And I think one of the burdens for Democrats is to be more creative and more critical when government isn't working, because then I think people will feel more confident that their money is being well spent.
What do you think of national, mandatory national service?
You know, I am actually a big supporter. My my wife ran an AmeriCorps program, national service program in Chicago, and I would actually like to see a system in which every young person had to get involved in some capacity, whether it was military service, non-for-profit work, government work, for the first year or two of their lives. As I said before, it actually, this isn't sort of eat your peas, you know, you need to do this just for the country. I actually think that young people benefit enormously from it, and it would be a good opportunity. One thing I wanted to say, I think a lot of young people would jump at the chance if it weren't for the fact that they're coming out of college with $50,000, $70,000, $100,000 worth of debt. So if we tied national service, a mandatory national service, to debt relief for young people, then I think you'd see a lot of takers.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Aisha Bonner, and I'm interning for AARP. I recently caught some remarks you made about the relationship between the Democrats and religion and how we've really sort of eschewed being associated with anything religious, and I'd like to hear you say a little bit more about that and how you think we can be more embracing and engage in a dialogue, because I think we're losing that fight.
Well, I gave a speech at Call for Renewal, which was a gathering of progressive evangelicals, is how they, I think, termed themselves. For those of you who are interested in the full text of the speech, it's on my website, and I think there's actually a video as well. My basic argument was this, that a large portion of the country is motivated by religious belief, and a large portion of Democrats consider religion to be important in their lives. And there is no reason why we can't, as a party, speak to those beliefs and those concerns. And in fact, if we don't, then our absence will be noticed and the void will be filled by the Pat Robertsons and the Jerry Falwells of the world, who will define faith and religion in a much narrower and less inclusive way. Now, what I also said was separation of church and state's important. We don't want, I at least believe that it is good not just for the state. It's not protecting the state from the church so much as it's protecting church and faith from the state. And so I don't want to see that wall breached. And I also think that for those who are religiously motivated, they don't have to leave their religion at the door when they enter into the public square to debate an issue. But at some point, it's important to recognize that in a pluralistic society, that we have to translate religiously grounded concerns into some universal language that can appeal to or at least relate to the experiences of people of different faiths or no faith at all. So, you know, if you're concerned about poverty, you can't just show up and say, God says, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. You've got to say, well, I think it's important for us to care for the poor because, it's good for the society, and it will cost less in the long run, and so forth. So it was a fairly complicated argument, but I think that the message was simple, which was that religion does not have to divide if both the religious and the secular have a sense of proportion and mutual respect, and that the Democrats need to stop feeling so intimidated in considering the issues. Although I also said if Democrats aren't religious, they shouldn't pretend to be. Nothing's worse than, I think, inauthentic expressions of faith. I use the example of the politician who shows up a week before election time and is kind of clapping off rhythm to the choir. People notice that.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Matt Skibiak. I'm with the National Academy of Social Insurance. And this question involves the partisan divide that you talk about in the United States. And something I hear a lot about, or a lot from politicians, is they say, or they identify the issues or the problems of the country. And so they'll say, oh, yeah, we have a lot of partisanship. But what exactly would you do to kind of bridge the divide that exists?
Well, as I said, I mean, there are some institutional problems that encourage partisanship. And it's interesting, I've got this book coming out in October, and I spent a whole chapter just talking about the institutional pressures on politicians that make them feel compelled to not cooperate with each other. And I've already mentioned some of them. I think we've got a media that's more polarized than it used to be. We've got a political districts that encourage the sort of partisanship that we're seeing. One of the things, I agree here with Arnold Schwarzenegger on the issue of creating nonpartisan maps, political maps, because I think we would be better off if we had a situation in which every candidate, every House member had to compete for Democratic votes and Republican votes and independent votes. And I think that would encourage and reward more bipartisanship. You have to be careful, though, because a lot of times bipartisanship ends up being the majority asking for 110% of what they want, then compromising on 15%, and then if the minority doesn't agree to the deal in which the majority is getting 95% of what they want, then they say you're being partisan. I have that experience on the Democratic side a lot of the times where, and Democrats are just as bad when they're in the majority, but that tendency for the majority to try to impose its will, and if the other side doesn't agree, well, they're being partisan. Well, no, it's just that you are not engaged in a serious dialogue. So I'm not looking for bipartisanship just for bipartisanship's sake. I want to actually solve problems. And I think that each of us who are involved in public life have to focus on solving problems. One of the things about the American people that I've found is that they're a profoundly non-ideological people. I think they're pretty practical-minded. I think that if you look at a problem like Social Security, or you look at a problem like our energy crisis, yes, there are some ideological differences. How much market-based solutions do we use versus government? Who's paying for it, and so forth? But the truth is that there's some common sense solutions available there that most people would agree to. If we ever got to a conversation about it instead of using it for as a political football, be a model for the kind of politics that I would like to see more of, and I think that if more candidates do so, if they refrain from a lot of backbiting and name calling and try to focus on solving problems, then maybe more and more people start rewarding us for doing that.
Up here in the
Yeah, right here. Go ahead.
Okay.
In the blue. No, excuse me. Yeah, you up there. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, please.
Okay. I'm torn between a career choice between community service and public service. I worked as a community organizer most recently on the west side of Chicago. And in that capacity, I get to be really close to people and work with immediate issues that people are facing. Since I've come to Washington, I've found that the federal government seems like it's a lot more detached from sort of real life and what really goes on. What's been your experience in your transition from a community organizer or community service to public service? And do you feel that real change comes from grassroots, or will it ever come from the top down?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think it's both and, not either or. I think you've got to have an empowered citizenry that is engaged to hold government accountable and to serve as a counterweight to the organized interests and well-financed organized interests that operate in government. So you can do all the great organizing you want on the West Side, but if there's no representation of the West Side in Washington, but there's a lot of representation from oil and gas companies or the pharmaceutical companies, then those results will show in terms of public policy. I would say in terms of your own personal life, I think it's where you get satisfaction. Some people enjoy the hands-on concrete nature of service work in the community, whether it's as a teacher or as an organizer or as a fireman, just having that very hands-on sense at the end of the day, I helped that person or this person. Others enjoy the policy arguments and puzzles that we face. And I think you can serve well in either capacity. So it really depends, I think, on where you get energy. One of the things that I think is most important is to make sure that when you wake up in the morning, even if you haven't had a lot of sleep, that you're getting energy from your work, that you're feeling excited about what you do. And some of that is temperamental. I remember, for example, I was a good lawyer, but I don't necessarily consider myself a great lawyer because temperamentally it was hard for me to sit in a library for days and days at a time just looking up cases. Now, I had law partners who were just, they loved nothing more than to spend time on finding just the right case that's right on point for the particular issue that we were dealing with. It's a temperamental issue in terms of what your gifts and skills are.
Now, all your bosses have called and asked where the hell you are, so we have time for one more quick question. Go right here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming, Senator Obama. My name is Jerry Leung. I'm over at the U.S. Department of Treasury. With your experience over at the State Senate, and then having come here to the National Senate for a year, I was curious what has been the most profound learning experience for you so far in your year here. What do you feel like has changed you? What changes do you feel like you've made so far? And, well, I really appreciate the refreshing idealism you bring from the non-public sector background. How do you propose, or how do you think you're going to be able to maintain that the longer you stay here in Washington?
Okay. I have been, I will tell you, and I'm not just pandering to my staff here, the thing that I've been most excited about over the year and a half that I've been in Washington is how many smart, talented young people there are working in Washington. I'm continually amazed and excited working with them, because I think it promises great things for the future. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of good ideas, and as I said, one of the things I notice among the younger generation is that they want to get beyond some of the old arguments that we've been locked in for, it seems like, years. They're not interested in simply defending
1930s programs, but they're also not interested in tearing down government. They want to figure out how do we make government work. And so that has been hugely refreshing. In terms of me personally, the biggest challenge and the biggest strain on me has been the fact that I didn't move my family to Washington, and so I'm away from my wife and kids 3 days, 4 days a week, and that's very difficult, and it's much more difficult for my wife. And I think that for those who are thinking about running for office as opposed to working in government, one of the things that you have to recognize is that it puts a severe strain on your family, and that is, now that's true also if you're working as an investment banker or a hotshot corporate lawyer, but there is the compensation of your spouse feeling like you're bringing home the bacon, whereas when you're in public service, it's sort of like, well, you get the satisfaction of knowing we're making a better world, which is somewhat more abstract. In terms of maintaining my idealism or my enthusiasm, what I find useful is to take satisfaction from what I do as opposed to the office I hold. I think the danger of for politicians is that you take so much satisfaction from being in a particular office and being called senator and seeing your name in the papers and the status of office that it creates an enormous fear about losing that status. And I would say that a good 50% of what's wrong with Washington has to do with fear. It has to do with people being so afraid to that this might cost them an election or put them in a disadvantage or cause some aggravation in the public that they don't want to take any risks. And so they play it safe. Either they play it safe by using the usual ideological models to solve problems, or they run negative campaigns that they know in their gut, I don't really feel good about this, but my consultants are telling me if I don't run this nasty ad, I might lose. Or they don't vote on an issue the way they really feel that they should because they think an interest group may jump down their throats. And I just constantly try to remind myself that if I'm here just to be here, then it's not worth the aggravation. I'm here because I want to get some things done, and if I can't get those things done, then it's not worth being here. I'd rather be home every night, and I'll figure out another way of doing it. So,
now before you go,
yeah.
Senator Harkin announced that this year's speaker in Iowa, September 17th, Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Why would a nice guy like you be going to a state like that?
Listen, I love Iowa. And, I hear the steaks at the steak fryer are pretty good. But I've been to now just since being elected to help other candidates, and Iowa's got some highly contested congressional races as well as a gubernatorial race, and since it's right next door, it's kind of hard for me to avoid.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks
guys.
For coming.
All right. Thank you, guys.